Good afternoon and welcome to our special Main Street broadcast. I'm Rachel Reeby. We're at the Duluth Convention Center where the New Horizons Mining Conference is getting underway. Governor Jesse Ventura will attend along with a handful of his state commissioners, U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone and Congressman Jim Oberstar. They're here along with industry experts to discuss the future of mining in Minnesota. For 100 years, Minnesota's mineral deposits have fueled one of the state's dominant industries. But mining is also among the most volatile. The Iron Range has enjoyed periods of rapid growth, followed by sharp downturns, followed by another wave of prosperity, and yet another slump. Experts say there's enough iron ore still in the ground to continue mining another 200 years at least. We'll talk about what it's going to take to keep the industry going. We're also going to look at other underground resources. Copper, nickel, and platinum are very real possibilities. My guests this afternoon are John Swift, Commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, and Ann Glumack, President of the Iron Mining Association. Good afternoon to both of you and welcome.
Good afternoon.
Listeners, our phone lines are open for your calls and comments. If you're in the Twin Cities, you can call us at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. The 90s were a productive decade for Minnesota mines, but they were not necessarily profitable. Over 43 million tons of taconite was produced last year alone, but one of Minnesota's seven mines is shutting down next summer, idling 1,400 workers. And Glumack, what are the major challenges facing your industry?
Well, I think right now, Rachel, what we need to focus on is remaining competitive in the face of some pretty big challenges. Primarily for us, what is causing us the greatest concern right now is the continued influx of imports from countries that may or may not have the same attention to trade laws that our companies do. We see an increase in the import of what's called semi-finished steel slabs. Those products directly compete with Minnesota's iron ore and create a huge problem for us. And similarly, our steelmaking customers are seeing imports on the rise and their prices that they can command for their products declining. So we're in this catch-22 of needing to sell more of our product, but finding that the imports are making that more and more difficult to do.
And can you come in at a price competitive with foreign materials, or is that almost impossible?
Actually, we believe that if the playing field is level, we can compete with anybody. We're incredibly productive, have doubled our productivity since the 1980s. What we believe, however, is that many of these products are coming in violation of trade laws, and you can't compete when the playing field isn't a level one.
So the laws are in place, but perhaps they're not being followed, John?
Well, we believe that that's a possibility, and that needs further exploration. When you take a look at some of the things that were done in Washington maybe a year or so ago trying to address steel imports, one of the things that was specifically exempted was the importation of slab steel. That is a direct competitor for our mines in northeastern Minnesota, and we need to pay attention to that and see if we can't impact that kind of a decision.
Let's talk about the closing of the LTV Steel Mining Company in Hoyt Lakes. This hasn't been a good year. It was announced that it would close. It will close next summer. 1,400 workers will be idled. And LTV was the oldest continuously operating taconite mining operation on Minnesota's famed Iron Range, the third largest producer of taconite pellets on the Iron Range. What happened?
Well, I think a number of things happened. One, you mentioned the age of the mine, and that's exactly right. And in addition to having an old operation, they had been mining close to their plant and had taken much of the ore, and were finding that as they had to move farther and farther away from their plant to get the ore, they were encountering not only the challenge of transportation, but also the fact that the overburden, all of the stuff that the glaciers deposited on top of that ore, was getting greater and greater and a much greater cost. The other challenge that LTV Steel Mining Company had was that they had a very unique way of cooking their pellets, hardening them up for shipment, and they used shaft furnaces. And those are really in place, as far as we're aware, only at LTV. They're not the most effective way of hardening those pellets, and the cost for replacing them was prohibitive.
So with LTV shutting down 1,400 workers, that's about 25% of your workforce in the mines. That hurts. And then you've got the fire at FTAC. That didn't come at a great time, did it?
No, we're having a pretty challenging year this year. The FTAC fire in particular is difficult in that they just had one about 2 years ago in a similar part of their operation, and were kind of getting up and running and really working on their costs. And now this is a temporary setback, we hope, for that particular mining company. But the LTV one clearly hurts, and John and his organization at the IRRB has been doing a tremendous amount of work and coordinating efforts to see what can be done to protect those jobs, or at least to find, I guess, a substitute employer for those people.
Did our governor get any takers when he was on late night TV?
We have had quite a few responses from the things that he has said there. He also went to a conference up in Saskatoon. It was a conference of heavy metal fabricators, and also gave the same pitch there in a speech.
Saying we have a place, we have workers, we have an infrastructure. Come.
And we have a group of people with a work ethic that's unmatched anywhere in the world. And while I'm not here to tell you that we've got a tremendously long list, we've got a few things yet to check out. And I am not pessimistic at all about what the outcome might be in White Lakes and LTV.
Will the closing of LTV and even the idling of EVTEC, is that going to help the other operations? We talk about seven mines, so that would we have one closing, one closed by fire. Is that going to help the other five? Will there be more demand for what they're able to supply?
Well, right now, Rachel, there are the seven mining operations in Minnesota and two in Michigan that are the U.S. producers of iron ore pellets. Cleveland Cliffs Incorporated, which has signed a contract to provide LTV steel with the pellets that it otherwise would have gotten from LTV Steel Mining, has operations both in Minnesota, Michigan, and in Canada. So I think we have yet to see how that's going to shake out over the long term. And I think with the situation at EVTEC, they're the recipients of their pellets. I don't know what their individual choices will be. They could look at Minnesota operations. That would be wonderful. But they also have opportunities to look at ore on the open market, and that could come from Michigan, Canada, or elsewhere.
Now, people might be listening and saying, well, 1,400 jobs, so what? But the economists have just come out and said 1,400 jobs in the mine translates into another 1,400 jobs that will most certainly be lost because those mining jobs are lost. And really, with 21,000 people employed in some way involved with mines, it's going to hurt everybody. It's going to hurt the Minnesota economy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We do business as an industry with companies all over the Minnesota. More than 200 communities in Minnesota have somebody who's working to support some activity in the mines. And so when we think of iron mining, we tend to think of northeastern Minnesota because that's where the physical mining operations are. But Minnesota iron mining clearly is a statewide industry. And the spinoff jobs are statewide as well, not just in northeastern Minnesota.
Our phone number, 1-800-242-2828 if you're outside the metropolitan area. 1-800-242-2828. If you're inside the metro, you can call us at 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. If you have a question about how long iron ore will be lasting or how it will be profitable, how we can make it more profitable, if you have a comment, please call us and join this program. You talked about LTV, about that. We talked about being one of the oldest mines and perhaps the equipment wasn't as modern as it could be. Really, reinvestment is a huge issue for your organization, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The industry spends on average about $100 million a year in Minnesota upgrading equipment, putting in new technologies to help us be competitive, and that is how we have been able to stay ahead of the competition to date. I mentioned earlier that the imports, both of the semi-finished steel slabs but also steel products in general, has really challenged us because many of our mines are owned by steelmaking companies, and because their prices are being driven down because of the imports, they don't have the kind of capital to invest. So it's becoming harder and harder for our Minnesota iron mining operations to attract the capital that they need to remain competitive.
Is that a place for state government to step in, John?
Well, there is a role that can be played in state government. When you talk about the huge amount of capital that's necessary. You know, we really need to be able to focus on the private sector and private investors to make up the vast majority of that. Minnesota has taken a step in the last couple of legislative sessions, though, to impact this kind of thing and promote new areas for perhaps value-added iron products. And what I'm referring to is the 21st Century Minerals Fund that we're going to be talking about more at this conference. This is some money that's been set aside to assist mining companies that would like to explore the next level of technology, the next generation of iron production.
And do we need to look in those directions? And it certainly has happened a number of times already in northeastern Minnesota when taconite was first discovered in a way of taking that material from the ground and making it profitable. If that had never happened, we would have been having this conversation a long time ago, wouldn't we?
Rachel, I think you're exactly right, and you touch on something that I think we need to bring focus on, and that is the fact that the state's investment in research has dwindled over the last few years. It was very, very fortunate when UW Davis developed the taconite process, but that's many, many years old now, and I truly believe that we are now on the threshold of the need for the next technology and the next generation of iron making. And the only way that's going to happen is for us to have investments in technology that bring us to that next generation.
And might these be state investments? We talked about some of the capital needed for equipment. Probably is not going to come from the state. That would need to come from private concerns. But should the state be taking a role? You said their interests have dwindled. Is this the time where their interest really needs to be piqued?
Well, I truly believe that it needs to be piqued, and we've been trying to accomplish that through our agency and in bringing this current administration up to speed with regard to what iron mining in Minnesota is all about. We brought up all of the commissioners and the governor and the lieutenant governor back in the summer and gave them quite a pitch on what mining means to the rest of the state of Minnesota and how we feel like we need to readdress this thing of investments in research. There is an amount of research going on, but I think one of the things that's evidence that our interest in this has waned over the years is that we no longer have a school of mining in Minnesota. I just returned from being in Las Vegas last week at the Mine Expo, and I would guess there were 10 or 12 at least states' schools of mining that had booths there. And to me it stuck out a little bit that here's Minnesota with such a leading role in mining, and yet we don't have a school. We do have the Natural Resources Research Institute right here in Duluth, and we have the Coleraine Lab, but I just believe that needs to be more emphasis placed on investments in research.
How much money do you need, John?
Well, I really think
realistically, are we talking hundreds of thousands? Are we talking billions? Are we talking millions? What do you think would be a figure that would go a long way?
Well, a couple million dollars a year for the next 5 or 6 years would make a huge difference.
Okay, that's on John's wish list for Christmas then. We'll go to the phones. Larry is in St. Paul. Good afternoon, Larry. Welcome to Main Street. Larry, we got you on the line?
Oh, hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Yes, I was just curious about the planned DRI, direct reduced iron, and how that would be supplied with carbon. It'd have to be either natural gas or coal, or what sort of economics that represents, because neither one is available in the state.
And so the question, Larry, is specifically what?
Yeah, where would that carbon come from? What sort of planning is the state doing for the future of DRI, given that there's no carbon readily available in the state?
Well, Larry, the approach to the DRI, I suppose that you're referring to the Minnesota Iron and Steel Project in Ashwaubenon. A part of that planning has to do with trying to get a natural gas line there of sufficient size to handle that kind of operation It is a major undertaking, but that would be the major supplier of the natural gas needed to run that plant.
Okay. Natural gas prices are very high and interruptible. Does that present a problem then?
Well, it certainly does. It certainly does, Larry, present a problem. Feasibility study that was done for Minnesota Iron and Steel, I believe, calls for $3 natural gas, and at current rates, it's higher than that. So it is a major stumbling block with that project. Now, that isn't to say that there isn't the possibility of a negotiation with a gas supplier that would get it down closer to their benchmark and their feasibility study, but you hit on an important point.
Yes.
We go now to Richard, who is on the phone in Minneapolis. Good afternoon, Richard. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much. Hello, John.
Hello, Richard.
Larry brought up a very interesting subject, and it's a subject that I was going to address, which was carbon-based fuels. The prices traditionally have been about $2 an M, and they're up around $5.80 an M now, which is prohibitive for the production both of DRI and taconite. I have identified a way of dealing with that and projected numbers of as low as $2 an M. I'm in the private sector. I don't wish to give my number out over the line, but I would love to talk to you privately. Can we go back to your screener and let me give her my number, and can we have a private conversation?
We'd certainly be open to that.
Thank you.
Jennifer from Rochester. Good afternoon, Jennifer. Welcome to Main Street.
Hey. Hello?
Yes, go ahead with your question.
Well, I have a quick question about if anyone up in that area has considered the dissolvable iron and if they want to be supplying that. I just read in a magazine that dissolvable iron is being dumped in what is otherwise considered barren and they have huge algae blooms that help soak up the CO2 in the air, and they're considering that as a way to help control the greenhouse effect and the hole in the ozone. And I was just wondering, I mean, that sounds like a really good way to generate some income up there. I was wondering if anybody had looked into that or heard anything about it, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your question. Anybody heard about that, dissolvable iron?
Actually, Rachel, I have not. One of the challenges we have as an industry is that iron is available worldwide. It's one of the most plentiful minerals available. I have not heard of that, and it might be an opportunity if it were something where you could do the processing and the transport to the place where it's needed the most, but that's the first I'd heard of that.
It's interesting that we're getting these calls. People have a lot of ideas, don't they? They have a lot of thoughts about how it could happen or how we could do it. Is that part of your jobs, to reach out and hear what other people have to say and to try to take some of those ideas and see if they're feasible?
Well, that's exactly right, Rachel, and that's a part of what this conference is all about. We've tried to bring together here for this conference the best minds in mining and to try to focus on the challenges and the opportunities that are before us. And a part of that effort is listening to any and all ideas that people have for addressing the opportunities here.
And let's talk about this boom or bust economy. Does it make it awfully difficult, even when you'd come to a conference like they're having in Duluth today here at the convention center? These aren't the happiest times to be in the iron mining business. This is in 1978. We're going through a lean period now. Is part of your job to prop people up and it's going to get better, it's going to get better? Do they say that to each other because it has gotten bad and better so many times before?
Well, I think you hit on a very interesting point, and that is part of this industry. I think it's part of any industry that's sort of in the commodities. It's no different than, for example, agriculture has booms and busts. What I think that our job is to, first of all, let people know that Minnesota Iron Mining, even though we're going through one of those lean times, is still a tremendous contributor to the state's economy and is still a very vibrant industry, even though we have our challenges. We did some focus groups a few years ago down in the Twin Cities area, and a number of people said, well, Minnesota Iron Mining used to be around, but now it's all closed. They went out of business in the 80s. And I think that sometimes what happens, because the natural inclination is to pay attention to the bad news, people forget to listen to us when there are good news and when we have wonderful production years or we have a new technology that's successful. So part of the job of a trade association like I represent is making sure that people know Minnesota Iron Mining employs right now about 6,000 people, that the average wage and benefit package for those employees is about $65,000 a year, that we contribute $1.5 billion to the state's economy every year. People tend to forget about us, but they only hear about us when it's bad.
So that's our pessimistic nature. That's why we sit up and take notice.
And Ann, I would like to add to your number, there are about 15,000 people whose jobs are indirectly relying on mining, many of which live in the Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm. And so should we be optimistic because of the 200 years of iron ore left in the ground?
Well, I think there's very, very good reason to be optimistic. We do have our challenges right now, but as you mentioned earlier, it tends to be a boom and a bust. We have a history in Minnesota of meeting the challenges that come up when we ran out of the natural ore or the red ore and developed taconite. People thought that would never happen, but all of a sudden we have $4 billion worth of taconite plants on Minnesota's Iron Range. We survived the 1980s, which were devastating to this region, to the industry. 10,000 people lost their jobs in northeastern Minnesota just in the mines alone. But what we did is we came out of that. We worked smarter. We are more efficient. We've doubled our productivity. We've formed partnerships with Johns Agency, the IRRRB, the Department of Natural Resources, the educational institutions. We've gotten smarter about how we need to do our business. And our challenge is to continue to find new ways to work smarter and to keep our costs lower. And we are working on that. The research dollars that John mentioned would go a tremendous way toward helping us, because some of the things that tend to get cut back when you go through lean times are those research institutions within the mines themselves. So we rely on our partners in the higher educational institutions and state agencies to help us with that.
Taconite is used in blast furnaces, and the number of blast furnaces are declining, and taconite is not used in electric arc furnaces. So this is part of the problem, that we're looking at the demand for taconite to go down. And so is it important that we find the future wealth in something other than taconite?
I think we don't want to get forced into an either-or situation. The blast furnaces that do exist represent a tremendous investment on the part of the steelmakers, and I believe that there will be, for the foreseeable future, quite a significant demand for iron ore pellets for those furnaces. But yes, looking at another product that can use the ore that we have in the ground for the electric arc furnaces or for foundries, I think is very wise. You don't then have your eggs all in one basket.
And has that been sometimes the problem in northeastern Minnesota? John, you might address yourself to that. People say, don't rely on mining because it goes up, then it goes down, then it goes up again. Have you done much to diversify? Certainly tourism in northeastern Minnesota has multiplied impressively in the last number of years.
Well, you're exactly right, Rachel, and there has been quite a bit done to try to diversify this economy. It really is the mission of our agency. The stated mission of our agency is to go out and find jobs that are alternatives to mining jobs. But we're not going to do that without trying to support the golden egg layer, as I call it, the mining industry. You mentioned tourism. Tourism this year, probably, in northeastern Minnesota, will move beyond $1 billion. Well, the mining industry is $1.5 billion, so it's not far behind mining as an impact in northeastern Minnesota. Nevertheless, we need to find employers who are willing to relocate in northeastern Minnesota, or at least create a presence up here so that we have some jobs that are maybe not related to natural resources at all. And we've had some success with that in the past few years, and We've got a lot on our plate at our agency right now with new possibilities and new prospects for getting that very thing accomplished. As a matter of fact, we took a look at various projects that we have put in place for the next year, and that's around 1,400 jobs in itself. They don't compare to mining at that level, but nevertheless.
They're not $65,000
no,
a year.
No, they're not.
So. something less
That's
than
right.
that. You're listening to a special Main Street radio show from Duluth. I'm Rachel Reedy, and we're talking about Minnesota's $1.5 billion mining industry with our guests, John Swift and Ann Glumak. We'll be back with more of Main Street after news and weather.
I'm Lorna Benson on Monday's All Things Considered, a look at the not-so-distant future of highway traffic management, where ramp meters take a back seat to so-called smart cars, vehicles that will sense objects, avoid collision, and monitor driver alertness. We'll have that story plus all the day's news on Monday's All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Good afternoon. It's 28 minutes before 1 o'clock. I'm Stephen John with news from Minnesota Public Radio. New violence broke out as leaders of Israel and the Palestinians gathered at an emergency summit in Egypt. A Palestinian policeman was killed and dozens of civilians were wounded in gun battles on the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Crews are using metal cutters to get through collapsed bulkheads aboard the USS Cole today, looking for the bodies of sailors still missing after last week's attack. General Tommy Franks, commander of the U.S. Central Command, toured the damaged ship at a port in Yemen. The Supreme Court has upheld a lower court ruling that the District of Columbia has no right to a vote in Congress. The justices considered two lawsuits seeking to give D.C.'s congressional representative a vote. The Supreme Court has cleared the way for Kellogg's to sue Exxon over Tiger logos. The cereal company says the cartoon tiger used by the oil firm is too close to Tony the Tiger, who's been on every box of Frosted Flakes since 1952. The European Commission has cleared Twin Cities-based General Mills' proposed purchase of rival Pillsbury from British-based conglomerate Diageo. The merger is still under review by the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission and the Federal Trade Commission. The 3-year-old North Dakota boy whose arms were reattached after being severed in a farm accident has lost his right arm and left hand. Parker Sieben's doctor said today the goal now is to allow the boy to return to his family within a few weeks. And the man whose name became synonymous with the communist movement in the United States has died. Gus Hall was born in Virginia, Minnesota. The American Communist Party says he died Friday at a New York hospital of complications relating to diabetes. Gus Hall was 90 years old. The forecast calls for partly to mostly cloudy conditions today, scattered showers and a few thunderstorms in the southwest with a slight chance of showers elsewhere. The Twin Cities has a forecast of increasing clouds with a high in the upper 50s. Duluth is at 45. It's 49 in Rochester and 49 degrees in the Twin Cities. That's news. I'm Stephen John.
Welcome back to this special Main Street radio show from the New Horizons Mineral Conference at the Duluth Convention Center. I'm Rachel Reedy. We're talking about the outlook and opportunities for Minnesota's mining industries with our guests, Ernest Lehman, president of the Minnesota Exploration Association, Ann Glumak, president of the Iron Mining Association, and John Swift, commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Listeners, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. If you're in the Twin Cities, you can call us at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. We go first to the phones. Gus from Brooklyn Park is on the line. Good afternoon, Gus. Welcome to Main Street.
Hi, my name's Duff, and I've got a question here that I'll take the answer off the line, but I would like to know about using taconite tailings in a joint public-private venture to build a recreational mountain so tourists and locals could go skiing and in the summer mountain biking or whatever.
Okay, so Duff, you're talking about combining mining possibly with tourism. John, is there any thought to heaping up taconite tailings?
Well, I think if you look around the Iron Range, there are plenty of mountains that have been created by the piling of overburden coming from the mining industry. But to take the taconite tailings, of course, they are in a basin for a reason, and that is a part of the environmental efforts to cut down any type of pollution. Technology that would pile those up so that they could create a skiing venue might be a little difficult to do. It would also be an investment that might be contrary to the fact that we already have a couple of skiing facilities in Minnesota at the present time, and that is not an industry that
creates great profits.
Rachel, one thing the industry is looking at, however, is using our coarse tailings as a substitute for gravel in aggregate for roadbed and different kinds of construction projects, which becomes increasingly important as the Twin Cities metropolitan area expands, kind of covers up its gravel pits and demands more and more concrete. So we're looking at using what is now a waste product as a benefit to the construction industry.
What is taconite?
Taconite is a form of iron ore. It has about 25 to 28% iron, and the rest is a waste product. And what we do with that ore is we grind it up very, very, very fine through a series of processes till it's about the consistency of flour. And we use very powerful magnets to pull those iron particles out, mix them with a little clay, roll them in a big drum until they form marble-sized pellets, and then we bake them and ship them off to the blast furnaces.
Thanks.
Welcome.
The first event of this Minerals Conference actually has nothing to do with iron ore. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources will open bids for non-ferrous mineral leases in four northeastern Minnesota counties, St. Louis, Lake, Carlton, and Cook. Ernest Lehman, how much interest is there in mining something other than iron ore in northeastern Minnesota?
There is currently quite a good deal of revived interest in exploration for other metals, mainly copper, nickel, and the platinum group metals, platinum, palladium, rhodium, in the what's called the Duluth Complex. I would expect this afternoon that there will be a number of bidders, active bidders for state leases in St. Louis and Lake counties, perhaps in Cook County, probably not further west.
This is a tremendously long process to go from getting the lease to actually pulling something out of the ground and making a profit, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. In one of my other hats, manage a project which involves some state leases and private leases in the Duluth Complex looking for platinum group metals, and we've been at it for 15 years already. We hope that within the next couple of years our exploration will be successful enough to move towards development.
So it's not all that unlike the discovery of iron ore. We talked in the first hour how men made fortunes, men almost made fortunes, men lost fortunes, all because the process was so long to find it and to get it out of the ground profitably. Is that the same thing in precious minerals, that you must have very deep pockets and a strong stomach to keep going?
Very, very deep pockets, very good luck, a strong stomach. All it takes, all those things. One thing that's happened in the last 20 years is that process has gotten a lot longer, partly because the process of getting the necessary leases, and then if you do discover something, getting the necessary permits, all of that has lengthened the process, so that from starting an exploration program to successfully starting development of a mine is probably a minimum of 10 years and possibly as long as 20 years.
What is Minnesota's reputation as a mining prospect?
Well, geologically, Minnesota is a very prime prospective area. Much of the northern part of the state encompasses what's called the Precambrian Shield, the Canadian Shield, which is a prolific area for mineral discoveries. Our problem is not, well, it's partly technical, because much of northern Minnesota is also covered by a lot of glacial material, which makes exploration difficult. Our problem in the last 10 or 15 years, besides the normal cycle of commodity prices, has been the perception by the industry that Minnesota is not a good place to do business. And that's, of course, one of the things we hope to accomplish by this conference, is to show that Minnesota is a good place to do business.
Not a good place because of perceived or perhaps not perceived, high taxes, and also because of environmental regulations? Are we very tough in this state, or are we following the national trend?
First of all, on the tax issue, this historically was an issue, but the Minnesota Exploration Association back about 15 years ago worked with the legislature to change that, the taxation system as it applies to the non-iron ore sector. The tax situation now is quite good. We have lower taxes than Ontario. We have lower taxes than Arizona on comparable deposits.
So things have improved on the tax front.
On the tax issue, things have improved. On the environmental permitting issue, we have in place now, and again, the Exploration Association cooperated closely with the DNR and with some of the environmental community back about 10 years ago through a study that was run, and then we now have in place what I think is a very workable and doable system of regulation. We now need a permit. We need a permit application. We need a successful ore body to test that that process out. But I think it's in place. I think it's meets the environmental needs, and I think it's workable from an industry perspective.
Once you have success in that arena, will everybody be right in the door behind you?
Well, we hope so. we certainly hope so. We may not be the first. We probably won't be the first one out of the gate. More likely, it'll be PolyMet with their project.
When you talked about the $2 to $3 million a year, that would go a long way. Part of the research, does it need to be in the arena of non-ferrous minerals?
Well, I think it does. Right now, though, I think most of the pressure is for us to try to find that next level of technology for iron mining. But I also believe that there is a need for that kind of investment in the area of the non-ferrous. You know, one of the things I really should point out that I didn't say earlier, this reinvestment on the part of the state, our agency has invested about $93 million over the last 7 years in iron mining. We have begun to make some investments in the area of non-ferrous. We have what we call our DIG program, which is a drilling initiative grant, where we'll provide some money to companies like Ernie's to make further exploration for non-ferrous deposits.
Our phone number, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're outside the metropolitan area, 651-227-6000. If you are in the metropolitan area, 651-227-6000. And is there room at the table for everybody, or do you get sometimes this sinking sense that you did have a brand new car, but now everybody's got a newer car and you're still driving the old model?
Oh, I really think that it's critical that we develop our non-ferrous industry. You know, Minnesota Iron Mining, as I mentioned earlier, is not just the seven mines that we have. It's hundreds and hundreds of businesses that form an infrastructure and a tremendous amount of expertise. We know how to do mining in Minnesota. And there are construction companies and equipment companies and engineering firms and technical expertise galore that is just waiting to be tapped for the non-ferrous industry. And frankly, I think that as a major taxpayer in this region, we'd like to see some other people contributing the revenues generated by additional mining. I think that it only makes the entire industry stronger as more and more players come to the table.
Is that infrastructure quite a carrot for companies wanting to come here to say, we know how to do mining. We have people that are already working in this area. We have the transportation system to get the goods out of here. Does that all help?
I think that's a very important aspect. Not only is the infrastructure there, there is a trained mining workforce. There is an attitude, a positive attitude about developing mineral resources in northern Minnesota. I might also add that comment on John's comment, there is a certain amount of money being allocated by various state agencies, DNR, the Minnesota Geological Survey, some legislative funding of John's agency, IRRRB, and in the area of research that related to the non-ferrous sector. And that's very important. Some of the things DNR has been doing on understanding how to deal with mine waste is very important. I had our partner from South Africa up here in June, and we went through some of the work that DNR has been doing. And it's very impressive. It's very proactive, and we want to get that message out to the industry that this is a good place to do business.
Let's go to our phones. We have Alan from Edina on the line. Good afternoon, Alan. Welcome to Main Street.
Good afternoon. I've got a quick question. I apologize. I missed a bit of the show before I got out for lunch here. I understand that there's, you know, a couple companies or one or two companies up north, I've heard about that, closed down recently because the actual product they're producing is no longer competitive on the world market. I don't know if it's the quality of the ore or if it's the cost. I didn't catch the whole story on it, but I understand that they're planning on closing down. They're hoping to have someone else reopen it. I'm curious, a couple questions, I guess. Are we just no longer competitive? And, I mean, is it a problem with our quality of our minerals? And also, how would another company, if it could be purchased, what would this other company possibly do better than the current company did and realize that they couldn't make money? I'm just curious on the outlook of those mines up there.
Thanks for your question, Alan.
Thank you.
Rachel, let me first perhaps bring up a point with regard to LTV's decision. LTV Steel made a decision that they were not going to be in the raw materials business across the board. In fact, they sold a limestone company in Michigan that was very profitable simply because they had made a strategic decision that they were going to be in the raw materials business. Well, that includes the production of taconite pellets. I think we also need to point out that while the LTV site does have the old shaft furnaces, the oldest technology on the range, nevertheless, there's been significant investments made in their crushing facilities, and they have a railroad. They have their own power plant. They have a number of assets there that would go a long way towards the capitalization of some alternative usage of that property. One of the things that our agency funded was a study to take a look at the possibilities of producing something in the way of a value-added iron product that did not require the usage of those shaft furnaces. And while that was kind of a back-of-the-envelope type study, nevertheless, it pointed that it was very possible that we could do that kind of thing with that ore body, with those facilities there, short of using those shaft furnaces. So there is a good, strong possibility that facility could continue to be used for iron.
When Alan talks about not being competitive, some people might be saying, wow, the average person working in the mines gets a package of $65,000 or $67,000 a year. How about if we said to them, ladies and gentlemen, let's work for $50,000 a year? Is there a question, a possibility of bringing those wages down, or is that never a negotiable item, Ann?
Well, I think we always look at all of our costs, but what we have to remember is that we have doubled our productivity over the last 20 years. We have doubled the amount of taconite pellets per worker hour on the Iron Range, and you don't do that without the cooperation and hard work and ingenuity of your employees. So I think that the wage and benefit package is a good one, but I also think we get a tremendous value for that. We are, as I mentioned, competitive as long as the playing field is a level one. And Alan mentioned the quality of our ore. Actually, the product that comes out of Minnesota's taconite operations is tremendously valuable in the blast furnaces. It's incredibly consistent. It has all of the physical and chemical parameters that the blast furnace operators need. So we have very high quality ore, and it's just the cost of processing it that we have to keep working at.
John from Wisconsin's on the line. Good afternoon, John. Welcome to Main Street.
Good afternoon.
This is not along the lines of the taconite iron ore mines, but has anyone explored the geological formations in Minnesota to see if oil would be possible to locate and bring in oil companies to the state?
Ernest, that's got your name all over it. So we're talking about palladium and rhodium and copper nickel. Okay, what about oil?
Well, the going through Minnesota, central Minnesota, in fact, underneath the Twin Cities and then swinging north into the Lake Superior Basin is something called the Mid-Continent Rift. This is an old billion-year-old rift valley like the rift valleys in Africa. And within that rift system, there are sandstones and shales that have been deposited, some of which are known to be source rocks for hydrocarbons. There has been some interest in the past in not so much oil as natural gas exploration in the rift system. There was some exploration done in Iowa within the rift system and some over in northern Wisconsin. There's been interest in Minnesota, but that's kind of a new frontier area that the oil and gas industry has not thoroughly explored. Maybe it'll be explored someday. I think it'd be very interesting and a lot of fun.
Let's talk about the Duluth Complex. The first hour, we talked a lot about delineating the Vermilion Range, the Mesabi Range, talked about the Cuyuna Range. Where is the Duluth Complex?
Well, the Duluth Complex and its associated rocks form a kind of a crescent-shaped body of rock extending from Duluth northward to the Ely area and then swinging eastward through Lake and Cook counties, and extend pretty much from the lake shore, so it's kind of, as I say, a crescent-shaped body. It's a complex made up of a series of basic, what we call basic rock intrusives, and these kinds of rocks elsewhere in the world are associated with copper-nickel deposits and with platinum and palladium platinum group metals deposits. Some areas in the world they're associated also with chromium. The prime example is in South Africa, a complex called the Bushveld Complex. The Duluth Complex is about one-third the size of the Bushveld.
But still could be very lucrative.
I think you'll see this afternoon quite a number of people bidding on properties within the Duluth Complex. There are identified resources of about 4 billion tons of low-grade copper-nickel ores along the northern and western margin of the complex. These have been explored from the 1950s on. This is where Polymet's project is, where there are a number of other known deposits in that area.
Which must be tremendously exciting for the people in your business. And yet when we talk about that other billion-dollar industry of tourism and the people that have retired up to Shagawa Lake and Burnside Lake and up to the North Shore, and all they want is the solitude, the northern lights, the loons. Are they having cardiac arrest as they're listening to how close they are to the Duluth Complex? Are these things compatible in any realm?
I think they're very compatible. Rachel, I think you need to know where I come from. I am in the resort business, and yet I feel that they're very, very compatible. All you have to do is get in an airplane and get over this region and take a look down. The wilderness here is very, very vast, and I think we can very easily cohabitate.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly do. I mean, even though I just mentioned throughout a number of 4 billion tons, which is not my number, it's actually the state's number, these are discrete deposits. They are limited in area. Some of them might be best operated as open pit mines. Some of them, like the project I'm working on, will undoubtedly be underground mines with a minimum of environmental impact. So I think they are compatible. I think if you go to Ontario, you'll see many operations which are in areas that are prime recreational areas as well.
Rachel, could I say something further there? You know, the whole issue of the environment and the idea that non-ferrous mining is a tremendous threat to that, that would have been true many years ago. But with the new technologies that are now used to beneficiate those precious metals, there's no longer the threat. There isn't the cyanide that goes out into the atmosphere.
Well, that's a relief to people listening. So there have been new technologies, so it doesn't have such a harmful impact.
That's exactly right. The new technologies don't use fire and cyanide. They use water and pressure cookers. And we visited the Stillwater mine in Montana, and there it was very apparent to us. Here is a mine that's operating very, very close to one of the top trout streams in Montana without any impact whatsoever on that river. Their smelter is in a small community where their buildings are right beside an insurance agency, and the environment is not adversely impacted there.
Ernie, let me just ask you in closing, 15 years you've spent looking for it, finding it, exploring it, figuring out how you're going to do it. How many more years do you and your company give it? Another 15, another 30, or do you have like a shorter timeline?
Well, I have a shorter timeline because I'm not going to be around that long. But we're hopeful on our particular project, of reaching some kind of definition late this year, early next year, and then maybe going on for a couple more years of detailed exploration.
But it's coming quick.
We hope it's coming quick, yes.
We are out of time for this Main Street special. Ann Glumac, John Swift, Ernest Lehman, thank you for being with us today. This special Main Street radio broadcast is a production of Minnesota Public Radio. Our engineers are Cliff Bentley and Alan Strickland in Duluth and Scott Liebers in St. Paul. Our producer is Sarah Meyer, site producer Bob Kelleher, and executive producer Melanie Summer. We'd like to thank Brian Heady and his staff for making this broadcast from the New Horizons Mineral Conference in Duluth possible. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Main Street. You'll be able to hear this broadcast as well as other Main Street reports. The address again, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street team consists of 12 reporters at NPR bureaus across Minnesota. I'm Rachel Reby.